Much bigger school. My old school is a neighborhood school. We walked there. We went home for lunch. Very comfy little spot. Much bigger school. We had to take a bus. I had a mean teacher. You ever have a mean teacher? My fifth grade teacher was mean. She said, "How many are buying? How many are bringing?" And I sat there like a lump. I didn't know what she was talking about. She said, "You idiot," in the front row, pointing to me. "You don't know whether you're buying or bringing?" And I said, "No." She said, "You know, lunch. Are you buying your lunch or have you brought your lunch?" I hadn't done either one. At lunchtime, I didn't get to eat a lunch. I was coming back to the classroom, and this big figure loomed up in front of me, and he pushed me up against the wall, and he said, "Bobby Mulkern, you are an awful little kid. You are a future criminal. But when you're in my school, you're going to reform. You're going to be a different character." This year, I said, "It's my first day of school. My name is David. I'm not Bobby Mulkern." He said, "Oh, yes, you are, you little rat." It's a terrible thing to be misunderstood. Imagine if you're God. God is the most misunderstood being in the universe. Lots of people in our world think of God as like a cosmic cop that can't wait to turn on the lights and pull you over in life. I was golfing out in Arizona, and I was paired up with three strangers. One of them said that he was a doctor. Another had his own business, and a third was a painter. So we're playing nine holes of golf, and these guys are drinking and swearing and losing a lot of golf balls. We got up onto the 10th tee to wait. You know, we were getting ready to hit our shot, and they introduced themselves. They told me what their professions were, and they turned to me and said, "And what do you do?" I said, "I'm a minister of the gospel of God." Dead silence on the 10th tee. Confession on the 10th tee, right? And I realized these men only think about God when they're feeling guilty, right? As if God was a cosmic cop. We had a fascinating theological discussion on the back nine. There's all kinds of misunderstandings of God. Some people think of God as a kind of a vague force in the universe, kind of a Star Wars force or an impersonal figure who got things going but doesn't want to connect with us. Jesus says, "No, he numbers all the hairs on your head, even when they're gray." He's a God who knows every step, every breath, every thought. He's like a father that waits for you to come home. So many misunderstandings. The church it wants to teach the world about God. You do it well here in Allentown. You start when kids are little. I love that children's message. You know, incredible. And you have programs for kids that last all year, and you have summer programs, and you have mission trips, and you have adult classes. People learn about God. It's a wonderful thing. The knowledge business. But you know, there's a difference in knowing about God and having experience of God, between information and encounter. How many of you are still looking for a mate? You don't have to raise your hands. You can just acknowledge it quietly. If you are, I wonder how many of you are doing so on a dating app. That has taken over America. People are a little worried about this whole dating situation. And so it reminds me of the lonely frog who had been kissed by many women looking for their prince and rejected. And he was upset about his romantic life. And so he called a psychic hotline in desperation to ask about his prospects. And the woman on the line said, "You are going to meet a beautiful girl who wants to know all about you." "Really?" he said. "Where?" She said, "Biology class." You know, people in America are nervous about dating, right? They don't want to get into relationships without knowing a lot about the other person. And so they will have these online relationships. They discover facts about education and interests and vocation and age and physical dimensions, all these facts about someone. But there comes a time when information has to become encounter. I know someone who did this for a year and a half out on the West Coast, and then can you imagine being on that airplane flying out to meet this girl for the first time? An actual encounter, the nervousness, the excitement, because we know there's a big difference in knowing about someone and knowing someone, knowledge of someone, intimacy. It becomes personal. The same thing with our knowledge of God. And so Allentown Church, like other churches, seeks to give people an experience of God. It happens in worship. Isn't it a wonderful thing? You walk off the street and you feel the presence of God. It happens on a mission trip. It happens on a retreat. It happens where two or three of you are gathered in a small group and you're sharing, and suddenly Jesus is in the midst of you. And what is knowledge about God becomes knowledge of God. It becomes personal. But I want to talk to you today about a third level, a third type of knowledge of God. And I want to show you a picture. I'll bet, who can be the first one to recognize where this is? Shout out when you know where this is. The Franklin Institute. How many of you have been to the Franklin Institute? I grew up in Pennsylvania. Every kid in eastern Pennsylvania goes there every year to the Franklin Institute. And the highlight for me was actually getting to walk inside this giant heart that's two stories high. This huge heart. How many of you have done that? Have you been to the heart? You know, it reminds me of what I've been preaching about so far. You know, we had knowledge of the heart. We learned facts about the ventricles and the chambers and how the heart beat and the mechanisms in the heart and the blood flow in the heart. And all of a sudden, we had an encounter with the heart. We were actually in the heart. But you know, there's a third level. I want to show you another picture. This is someone you don't know. All right, that guy on the right grew up in Pittsburgh. Moved out to Arizona eventually, and his heart began to die. And so a few years ago, through the miracle of medicine, he had a heart transplant. He got someone else's heart that had been in an accident. Can you imagine? His heart was transplanted. His life began all over again. His name is Ron Norris. Ron Norris is a little picture of the third kind of knowledge of God, because God wants to work in us a heart transplant. He wants us to delight in the same things he delights in. And he wants our hearts to break and us to feel his sorrow over the things that do break his heart, his magnificent heart. And to do that, his heart has to live in us. It's the third level of knowledge of God. You know, some people think that God is kind of cross. God, Dallas Willard says, is the most joyous being in the whole universe. How many of you have ever had fish? You ever have a little tank of fish? You know, it's amazing. We have a little tank of fish, these little iridescent creatures, and it's marvelous, and we smile, and it's wonderful. Think about God. He's got a whole planet of seas that are full of fish, and he sees them all the time in all their glory. We get to look out into space through the Hubble telescope, right? We see the Eagle Nebula. We get a little peek at that. God sees all the time. Galaxies cartwheeling, cataclysms of cosmic movement. He sees inside stars the formation of planets, the nuclear processes that form the stardust that makes up you and I eventually, the carbon in the universe. He sees all these big things. He sees all the little things. God delights. His heart is full of joy when that little child, you know, suddenly pulls herself up, right? And becomes a sumo wrestler. You ever see that? First steps. Right? He delights. He delights in every discovery that you make as a student, whether you're in the first grade or you're a Nobel Prize teacher in an Ivy League school. God delights when you meet challenges, when you overcome sorrows. God delights when you confess honestly. God delights when Enoch sings and the band plays. That was awesome today. How different would our lives be if the heart of God's delight beat in us? If we delighted in one another the way he does? If we saw all around us the miracles and the marvels? But what about the sorrow? What about the sorrow? Did you hear Nehemiah today? Nehemiah had a moment where he suddenly was called to experience the broken heart of God. You see, the people of God in 587, they were decapitated. The Babylonians came and they took the leaders of Israel. They took the kings and they took the leaders and they took the priests and they carried them off into captivity. They had to become exiles. They lost their temple. They lost their capital, their city. They lost everything that was familiar. They lost all of their religious rituals, all their economic life. And suddenly they were in a new land and they were depressed. Can anyone give me Oh, I mean, some of the most depressing poetry in the world is in the Psalms. How can we sing the Lord's song? By the rivers of Babylon, we sat down and wept. We couldn't worship, we just cried. But you see, some people learn from God. They learn from the prophets like Jeremiah that wherever you are, God is. Whatever situation you're in, God is there. It may seem miserable to you, but God can be present in it. And Jeremiah said, you better pray for the city that you're in. You better connect with the people. You better continue with your lives and flourish where you are. And Nehemiah's family had done that. So 100 years on from the exile, this guy had risen up against the odds. Don't you love an immigrant who comes into a situation and has a great life? He created a great life for himself. He became an advisor to the king. They call it a cupbearer, and we think that's a barista. No, no, no. He was a member of the cabinet in Susa, in this huge empire, right? The great king, Artaxerxes, who ruled for 44 years in the 5th century, starting in 465, he was an advisor to this man. And then comes the sad part. His brother visits from Jerusalem with a couple of friends, and he says, how are things going in Jerusalem with the people who weren't deported, that little remnant? And they said, they are sick at heart. It is awful trouble and humiliation for the people that are there. The gates are burned, the walls are broken down, they're vulnerable, they're hurting, they're dispirited. And did you hear the reaction that our reader read? Did you hear it? He began to mourn, and he began to pray, and he prayed for days, and he mourned for days. And then he did a very, very brave and foolish thing. He went to see the king. This king who had promoted him and nourished him and blessed him and advanced him and supported him and made him a rich man. He said, King, how about if I quit? How about if I turn my back on all you've done for me and no longer serve you? How about if you let me go? And oh, by the way, king, can you give me some money? Can you give me some resources? Can you give me some authority? Because I want to go, I want to travel for 4 months back to Jerusalem, and I want to fix the city for my people, for the people of God. It was a brave and a difficult thing that Nehemiah decided to do. It was hard. There was ridicule and scorn. A lot of people just thought it was an impossible thing to do, right? And so they scorned him. That's difficult. There were opponents there in the town. There were the Samaritans led by Sambalah and Tobiah, who was leading the Arab faction. And they began to sabotage the work so much that the workers had a trowel. They're trying to build the wall, right? Cement the wall in one hand, and they had a sword in the other hand. It was difficult. It was complicated. But what an impact Nehemiah had. Because when the gates were restored and the wall was built, the people of God had a start over moment. What an accomplishment. The people of God got to connect with their previous history in their capital and begin their life and their worship again. They got to praise their great God. They had a start over moment. And without Nehemiah, no Jesus. Without Nehemiah, there's no place for a little Jesus to go and learn in the temple. There's no place for him to teach. There's no tradition for him to fulfill. There's no law for him to revise and give great new meaning to. What an accomplishment Nehemiah had. You know, this third level where you get a transplanted heart, have you ever seen it in your life? You ever experienced it? My wife and I had kind of a bumpy road to matrimony. You know, that I met her at Oxford in England, and we dated, and then I kind of broke up and came back to the States up here to Princeton to do a PhD, and after 2 years, I contacted her. I went over for a week at Christmas time, and she came over here at Easter, and I proposed. So we'd been together like 10 days over the previous 2 years. And that crazy woman said yes for some reason. And so we were planning to get married in the summer, and she was going to move to the States in the fall. And how are we going to support ourselves? I was a poor graduate student teaching at the seminary, and she was a teacher. And so we decided to take tours of 3 Princeton schools, just in hopes we might meet someone, make a contact, maybe she would get a job offer. We did 3 tours. She got 3 job offers. $35,000 a year, $30,000 a year, and $8,500. Guess which she took? She took $8,500. I was aghast, but I wanted this woman to marry me and make the sacrifice to come here, so $8,500. Have any of you been to the Stewart School, Sisters of Sacred Heart? That's where she went. Now I want to show you a little picture up here in the center of the school. I don't know if you can see this, but that in the center of the school is a picture of Jesus. So there's a central pillar, and all the floors and all the movements and all the classrooms build off this central picture. And it is a picture of the sacred face and heart, the bleeding heart of Jesus that flows down into the floor in that school. It was created by, the school was created by an architect in Princeton called Jean Laporteau, and he only ever did one building, this building, and he was the dean of architecture in America. 17 of his students became deans in other colleges. This building has classrooms that are open to the side, but right in the center is the bleeding heart of Jesus. And this is because this is part of the work of the Sisters of the Sacred Heart. Now, how many of you have ever met a nun? Have you ever met a nun? These little ladies, there were eight of them in the school, they were all octogenarians, all right, all over 80 years old, and they were all about this big. And I thought I understood the mission of the school. It was to educate these prim and proper young children from Princeton. You know, let's face it, they are the children of so many amazing families, highly educated, highly successful. Princeton is one of the most competitive educational environments in the world. When I was there, in order to get into a preschool, you had to have a resume. No kidding. Now they have to have a video resume to get into preschools, some of the preschools in Princeton. So educating these girls to be leaders of American society, a great mission, right? But I discovered the first week they had a second mission. Because these octogenarian ladies got in a 1965 Pontiac station wagon, you know, the kind with the fold-up seats, right? And these little ladies drove down to Trenton, to a neighborhood that was broken and benighted, a neighborhood with dilapidated housing and crappy schools, a neighborhood where there were drug dealers, where it was dangerous. And my wife, bless her heart, said, you know, we're going to go with those sisters down there. We're going to go down and see what they're doing. And so we followed them down and we began to work tutoring these kids. You see, there was a second mission. And I realized at that time these sisters had transplanted hearts. You see, they knew that it delighted God for all those children in Princeton to realize their potential. That delights the heart of God. Young people, when you use your gifts and you use your minds and you commit yourself to growth and exploration, it delights the heart of God. But what was breaking the heart of God was all those kids in Trenton, in the inner city, who were not succeeding and not going forward, and their lives were blighted. And so these little octogenarian ladies and my wife and I had Wednesday experiences. Eventually, we didn't have kids at that time. We ended up with Dwayne and Shanika and Shante. We had a whole new family. There's something very powerful about a transplanted heart. But you know what I learned? Down there and through this church, I learned something powerful. I learned that the joy of God and the sorrow of God are not disconnected experiences. It's not delight on one hand and sorrow on the other, but that the deepest joy comes from moving into the places in life where there is the darkest and there is the deepest sorrow. Think about Nehemiah. He moved into this broken place in Jerusalem. It broke God's heart that Zion, the city of the great king, the joy of the whole earth, was in ruins and his people were in misery. Hard job. But think of the joy when the walls were rebuilt, when the city was safe, when the worship began again, when the band started playing, when the people started celebrating, when the story of God's people had a new chapter. Was there joy? Oh, yes. Think about, for a minute, the things that broke Jesus' heart. Think about the fact that he encountered friendless tax collectors who were cut off from their community, and women like the woman at the well who were broken down with guilt and shame, and crowds that were like sheep without a shepherd, and fathers that had lost a child to disease, and the prostitutes and the poor, the sick and the sick at heart, the hurting and the helpless. It broke his heart. But think of the joy as he moved into those situations, as he saw the kingdom come. Think about the people that were lonely that got befriended, and the woman who was forgiven, and the crowds who got a good shepherd. They got direction. Think about the father whose child was brought back from death into life. Think of the joy. I want to thank Allentown Presbyterian Church and Stephen and Liz Heinzel Nelson. You have been, for me, like Nehemiah. You have been for me like Jesus. You have shown me what it means to have a transplanted heart. These two brave people went from the security and the beauty of this town. This is a beautiful town. It is an awesome place to live. And they went over to Africa and their hearts were changed. Steve and I had known before quite well. He became a different person, didn't he? And a different pastor. After that time away, he and Liz learned to delight in new things, like 2.5-hour worship services, right? Like people who, when the time for offering comes, they don't just pass the plate, they dance up and down the aisle. I mean, it's crazy, right? You came to delight in communities where, despite poverty and suffering and difficulty and starvation and long odds, there was a faith that was so joyous and so full. There was a welcome that was so amazing. And your hearts also began to break for the people without water, for the farms that were below subsistence, for the lean seasons when people get hungry, for the lack of schools and medical care, for the diseases that ended lives too early, for the fact that so many struggled to survive that they could never thrive. And so when you came home, you and this wonderful church began to challenge other people, and you challenged us in Toms River to have a heart transplant. And, you know, initially when we heard about it, I think some of us, some of our leaders, we said, come on. That's just not going to happen. It's hard enough to get our people excited about mission, you know, down the street or across the state. How are we going to do that for a place you got to fly 24 hours to get to? Language barriers, cultural barriers, racial barriers, come on. 1,000 reasons why it can't work unless you have a transplanted heart. So many obstacles were overcome. And these two built a strange, strange coalition. Big churches and little churches, Texas, New Jersey, Arizona, schools, colleges, engineers, doctors, nurses, the young and the old, men and women. And I just want to thank you for letting us be part of it. What an incredible joy to see people moving into these problems across the world and to see the kingdom coming. Because of you two in this church, I got to stand there when water came out of the ground for the first time in a village that had never seen water in their village. Let me tell you, those women were dancing and they were singing. They had been given through this ministry 2 hours or 3 hours more in every single day to bless and teach and to parent. I got to go into a village that had never seen a white visitors. I was a little scared about that, you know? Never seen white people, but you know, they were lined up to greet us and to bless us and to encourage us and to thank us for coming to them. I got to see electricity create a new mill. I got to see women become bankers in these villages doing microfinance. I got to see a school open for the first time. Wow. Oh, amazing, amazing stuff. We could go on and talk about the miracles there. But I just want to close with this. You've given to us and all those who partnered with you an unspeakable joy. You have put us into relationship with Christians like these dear people in the front, whose faith and love dwarfs my own. You have helped the kingdom to come in amazing ways here and in Africa. I want to thank you with all my heart. We're doing a big campaign to transform our church and bless our mission partners. I got to pretend I was a rich person last night. It was so fun. At the fundraiser, I had been instructed that I should bid based on the money that our church was giving for this new school. And so I just pretended I was a rich guy. And the bidding went up and I got to give $65,000 for the school. And $35,000 in matching grants. I'll never get that experience again to raise that number and pretend I was a rich guy. But I have been enriched. I have been made richer. I've been helped to get a heart transplant. So we're calling our big project in Arizona a new heart for the valley. Because thanks to you, you changed my life and my ministry and my outlook and my experiences. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we just thank you for the blessings that have flowed out from this sanctuary. for the pure hearts, for the strong faith, for the willingness to hold hands across continents, across space and time and language and culture, to trust that where your people gather, you will do miracles. Give us transplanted hearts as we move forward. Don't let us settle for knowledge about you, even knowledge of you. Let us move on to transplanted hearts that change the world and build the kingdom. We pray this in your Son's great name, and all God's people said,